You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Huston was deep in the Belgian Congo directing the African Queen when word came by way of a barefoot messenger that he was the father of a healthy baby girl named Angelica. In her memoir, A Story Lately Told, Angelica Huston writes about growing up with parents she describes as big characters, her Academy Award-winning director, actor, screenwriter, father John, and her glamorous mother, Enrica, who had trained as a ballerina under George Balanchine and danced on Broadway with Jerome Robbins. The book is published by Scribner, and we are re-airing it for you on this President's Day holiday. I began by asking Angelica Huston, were Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart, who was starring in The African Queen, the first of your father's friends and colleagues to even know that you'd been born?
I believe so. And Lauren Bacall actually told me the story later on. So she was also there.
She was on location?
She was on location.
Just hanging on?
She was cooking for everybody.
Well, Humphrey Bogart and many other famous actors, writers, and artists were family friends. How old were you when you first understood that your family was different from other families and that W.H. Auden, Henry Moore, and Edna O'Brien didn't just drop by everyone's homes for dinner or spend a couple of days?
Well, I think the first time I had an inkling that my father did something unusual was when I went to visit the location of Moby Dick in Fishguard, Wales, and walked onto a set which had, I remember, a lot of sawdust on the floor and a very tall man, dark man, handsome, in a top hat. And this turned out to be Gregory Peck. And I remember being sort of filled with wonder because it obviously was period, but I didn't really recognize it as period. It was an odd feeling, and my father seemed to be in command of all of this. I wasn't, again, quite sure what he was doing in the midst of everything, but he was telling people what to do, and it was a scene in an alehouse. So there was a lot of kind of ribaldry going on. But I think that was the first time that I had an inkling that he did something different.
You were born in California, but you spent your childhood in Ireland on an estate called St. Clarens. What part of Ireland is that in?
That's the southwest of Ireland, about 20 miles from Galway Bay.
And did your parents ever tell you why they chose to raise you in Ireland? Are either of them of Irish descent?
Well, my father's of Scots-Irish descent, sort of by way of Canada, they came down to America. But my mother was Italian, New York Italian.
And your father, you and your older brother Tony, became Irish citizens some years later. Did your father ever tell you why he decided to become an Irish citizen? Are you still an Irish citizen?
I still carry an Irish passport as well as an American passport. When he changed nationalities, I was only 13, so I didn't have to renounce, mercifully, my American citizenship, which I treasure, but as well as my Irish citizenship. I like carrying my green passport, too. He decided, I think, to raise his children in Ireland because he didn't want us to be spoiled in the way I think that Hollywood kids were turning out to be troubled and spoiled at the time. And it was a way to, I think, extract us from this atmosphere of celebrity.
But did it also isolate you?
Because yes, it
living
isolated
on an estate, you don't hang out with the local kids, do you?
No, you don't really, although we hung out with – my brother and I hung out with our groom, Patty Lynch's kids, and we were always outside. We were always playing, and it was a very kind of free childhood.
Well, the living conditions were rather unorthodox. There were two houses on St. Clarence property, and your father lived in the big house. You lived in the small house with your mother and Tony. How far apart were the two houses?
Not that far, a few hundred yards across a bridge and a trout stream.
Well, wouldn't separate bedrooms have sufficed?
I don't think so. Didn't seem to. The big house was sort of my father's realm, and the little house my mother's. And of course, Tony and I went up to the big house a lot, and we took our meals there, and sometimes we stayed over. But the little house was really our domain.
And you say that when your father was home, because he often was away, you and Tony would go to his room in the morning before he'd gotten out of bed to tell him stories. Was he training you at a fairly young age to think creatively?
I think he probably was. We didn't go up to his room with the intent of telling him stories, but we'd go up and we'd share breakfast with him, and then he'd say, "What news?" And then it was up to one to come up with something, even though we'd sort of seen him the night before.
And then he would sometimes draw or paint during those early morning visits while he was still in bed.
Yes, he loved to sketch, and this he did regularly.
Well, he had studied painting, hadn't he?
Yes, he had.
When he was young?
He was an art student and had studied in France, too.
And even had made a living as a portrait artist in Paris.
Indeed he had.
I'm assuming that is one of the reasons why he had such a strong visual style as a filmmaker.
I think that's true, and he always claimed that he was never going to be a very good painter, although I have some evidence to the contrary. I think he was a very good painter, but maybe a better director than anything else.
Did he collect art?
Yes, he did. He had some beautiful work. He had some splendid Juan Grises. He had a very beautiful Monet that later went to the Houston Museum. He had a very eclectic taste.
Were you able to get any of those pieces when you moved?
Well, there was one piece that I wanted. When he sold St. Clarence, he gave me a choice and said, you know, is there one thing that you would like to have? And I chose a little Rodin that had lived on the mantelpiece in the drawing room, a man, woman, and child all sort of molded as one that was very moving to me because it was sort of the perfect family that never was.
And your family especially.
Yes.
When your father was married 5 times. Your mother was his fourth?
Fourth wife, yeah.
Both of your parents were passionate about horses and were skilled riders. He kept a stable?
Yes, he did. And he, actually, before I was born, he had a ranch in Tarzana. And he kept racehorses there. He was fond, very fond of horses, and loved to hunt, loved Irish hunting. And I think—
That's fox hunts?
Yes, that's fox hunting.
In the
hunting.
English tradition?
No, in the Irish tradition, which is much more rough and ready.
And so you wound up learning how to jump and also go on hunts?
Yes, I did. I first hunted my first sort of grown-up hunt. First, when you're a child, you follow the hunt on your ponies, and then the day comes where you're considered adult enough to go out with the rest of the lions and tigers. And I very much enjoyed it, except my father, he liked me to ride side saddle, and that was sometimes a bit exacting.
And you were thrown a number of times.
Well, you have to be thrown in order to be a rider.
But he expected you to make the best of it, get back on?
Well, that's also what makes a rider.
My guest is Angelica Houston, who has written a memoir, actually the first of 2 projected memoirs.
That's right.
This one is A Story Lately Told, Coming of Age in Ireland, London, and New York. It's published by Scribner. Why that title?
Well, in Ireland, when you're traveling in the car, we used to play a game, my brother and I, which is it's sort of like, you know, spotting red cars, except in this case we spotted magpies. And magpies are black and white birds, big like crows, and they're actually notoriously mischievous and they steal things. But there's a poem, an Irish poem, that goes 1 for sorrow, 2 for joy, 3 for a wedding, 4 for a boy, 5 for silver, 6 for gold, 7 for a story lately told. And that's where my title comes from.
You obviously like that poem. Did you grow up with an Irish accent?
I did.
So you had to unlearn it?
Well, no. I just learned other accents on top of it. My parents were American, so I always had that sound in my head. But I was adaptable, and so whoever I was with, I was apt to take on their parlance.
And that's something that actors are particularly good at.
I think we are, and we're considered a bit superficial for it. I know that I spend about 5 minutes among Irish people, and I'm out Irishing the Irish.
You write that you adored your dad the way most daughters adore their fathers, but that you also were afraid of him.
Well, he could be tough, and when I was very little, he was very benign and very gentle, and then later when I started to grow up and reach adolescence, he became more critical.
And you describe an incident which occurred when you were a teenager, when your father slapped you.
Yes.
Did that come as a surprise?
It did. It came as a big surprise. It was the only time it ever happened, and I'd obviously pushed him to the limits, although I still don't advocate slapping your child.
Well, you were just testing out your sexiness, is the way you describe it.
I think I was, yes. I thought I was a really good dancer, and he disapproved. He accused me of dancing the bumps. And it was a word I didn't really know what it meant, although I had an inkling when he brought it up. And that conversation degenerated into something that I think neither of us was really prepared for.
Well, if he had been perhaps a model of rectitude, some of these things would make more sense. But He was married 5 times, and who knows how many other women were in his life. He had a gambling problem, didn't he? Wasn't money tight at times?
Yes, I don't. I wouldn't have said it was a gambling problem any more than he had a drinking problem. He drank and he gambled, but in those days it was what men did. It wasn't necessarily a problem.
How much were your other siblings in your life?
My brother, Tony, was a year older than I was and was constantly in my life.
He didn't go into acting as a number of the others did. He became a lawyer. Is that because he was rejecting that lifestyle?
Well, actually, he's not a lawyer. He's a falconer, and he still flies his birds. In fact, he was going to come out to New York this weekend to celebrate with me, but he's got a big hawk meet somewhere in Arizona or Albuquerque. So he's very dedicated to that, and I think something of a loner himself, but a fascinating person.
But Danny Allegra, says wonderful things about you. She was on our show.
She's my baby. I love Allegra, and she's written a beautiful book herself that sort of inspired me to write mine, since she was so clear and truthful and honest, and she has a tremendous ability.
And you wrote this book, I'm assuming, by yourself.
I did, yes. With the help of my editor, Bill Whitworth, who I love very much. But other than that, I had no ghostwriter.
Because the book is getting wonderful reviews, and many people have commented on how lovely the writing is.
Well, thank you. I guess I have to thank my English upbringing for that, my school years.
Well, you say your mother was a good writer, and you've included letters in this book that your father sent you that are really beautifully written. So perhaps it just comes naturally to you.
I think children whose parents talk and read are very much at an advantage.
My guest is Angelica Houston, the Academy Award-winning actress and director, who has now written a memoir called The Story Lately Told, Coming of Age in Ireland, London, and New York. It's published by Scribner. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had last November with Angelica Houston about her memoir, A Story Lately Told, Coming of Age in Ireland, London, and New York. I asked her, this book only covers the years between your birth and when you turned 22 years old and moved to Los Angeles. It stops before you launched your acting career and before you started your 16-year on-again, off-again relationship with Jack Nicholson. Why did you decide to end the book when you did?
Originally, it was going to be one book, and I think for reasons, mostly I think because this book was due out this year, my publisher, Nan Graham at Scribner, decided that it should be two books, and the next one to follow next year.
And you've already written it?
Not fully, but I've made a first pass.
At the end of this book, you thank Papermate for the Sharpwriter number 2 that allowed you to write the book by hand.
It did, yes. Wonderful pencil.
So you
highly recommend it.
You would not write on a computer.
No, because it's not my first instinct. I didn't grow up typing, and I enjoy the sort of brain to hand experience. It works for me.
When you were a kid, what did you think you'd want to be when you grew up?
An actress.
Well, you had your acting debut when you were 8 years old, and you and a couple of friends performed the witches scene for Macbeth for some visitors, which included Peter O'Toole. That's got to be a little scary.
Indeed it did, yeah.
What happened?
Well, we chose our outfits, and I, of course, chose the hottest black blanket, which I thought was very effective. And we had – my brother was doing the lighting, switching on and off the light switches at the door, the assembled guests gathered in the front hall to watch this performance. And I got to the line, "Toad that under cold stone," and completely lost it and gazed out into the audience in my memory and made a dash from the scene to go hide behind some curtains and, you know, cry while my brother searched for me and threatened all kinds of mayhem. But it was funny because a couple of years ago I was in Los Angeles and Peter O'Toole was there to get his star on the Walk of Fame. And I went along to see him and I said, "Peter, do you remember when I ran out of Macbeth?" Because I was only 6. Do you remember what a debacle that was? And he laughed and he said, "Don't you remember? I caught your eye." And all of a sudden I had this memory, this sense memory of catching that flashing blue eye and totally losing it, forgetting everything.
So that's what made you lose it?
That's right. The effect of Peter O'Toole, yes.
You also kind of, you cried in your mother's lap.
I did. I sobbed.
It sounds like you and your mother, who was known as Ricky, had a really close relationship. Did you share a lot of interest? She was a dancer.
She was a dancer. She loved theater. She loved movies. She was very well read, very sensitive, incredibly beautiful, very beloved to me, and taught me most of the things I know.
How old were you when they divorced?
They never divorced, actually. They separated when I was about 10. 10, 11.
Well, but they had eventually he married another. Oh, but she died.
Only after she died, yes.
But after they broke up, you moved with her and your brother to London. Was that a difficult adjustment? After all, you've been living in rural Ireland and now you're in one of the most bustling cities in the world.
I hated it. For the first year, I was sent to the French Lycée, and although I'd had French tutors growing up, I wasn't completely colloquial in French, and I had a lot of trouble keeping up, and they put me in the back of the class, and I was sort of considered the class idiot, and I was forced to repeat classes for 2 years, and it wasn't much of a success.
Well, lycées may be difficult for anyone who doesn't speak French perfectly to start with. I work with someone who went through a Lycée Kennedy here in New York, and she was one of the two kids who became pariahs because they weren't born in France.
Well, that was me. I was considered openly stupid, yeah.
And then you were overjoyed when your mother pulled you out of school, even though it was because of a serious injury.
Well, I'm not quite sure how serious the injury was, but I was pushed over in the school playground at some point and fell in a weird way and hurt my neck. And because one was only allowed to go into the nurse's office in recess, if it was extremely cold, nobody allowed me to go and see the nurse. So by the time I got home, I was kind of pale and shaky, and my mother took me to a doctor who claimed that he'd seen some fractures in my neck. And so I was put in plaster from my chin to my shoulders and actually enjoyed the experience a lot because it kept me out of the lycée.
Were you going back and forth between London and Ireland?
I was, yes. I was going back to Ireland on my holidays.
And then there was a tragedy. Your mother died in a car crash when you were just 18 years old.
17.
What were you doing at the time?
I'd just done a film with my father called A Walk with Love and Death in Vienna. And I'd come back and I was understudying Marianne Faithfull in Tony Richardson's Hamlet. And my mother had gone on a holiday, a driving holiday, and she didn't come back.
Well, you had stayed away from acting after the Macbeth debacle, but then Franco Zeffirelli wanted you to audition for Romeo and Juliet, and your father stopped that?
Well, it wasn't that I'd given up anything after the Macbeth debacle because, you know, after all, I was only six when that happened. But when I was 16, I made a movie with my dad, and he was very adamant that I should do it. He, I think, felt that he was doing a grand gesture. It wasn't a happy collaboration.
For a number of reasons.
For a number of reasons.
It made you uncomfortable, but also wasn't there a rather intimate, some intimate love scenes in a film? You're being directed by your father?
Yeah, I didn't enjoy that part of it. But overall, I didn't really identify with the character. And I think Dad felt that he was doing something wonderful for me, which doubtless he was, but it wasn't the way I wanted it to go.
He had already directed his father in The Treasure of Sierra Madre.
That's right.
With one of the great performances in movies. The family has had three generations of Academy Awards, hasn't it?
It has, yes. I'm the third.
So I wondered about directing family members.
Well, I think if they're willing, which I certainly was by the time Preetzi's Honor came around, I think it can be a wonderful thing. On the other hand, a reluctant actress is something that one should never become involved with. And the first time I worked with my dad, it was just that, and I was very stubborn, and I didn't really know what I was doing. So that wasn't a great experience, but
did you get decent reviews?
No, I got terrible reviews. I was badly criticized.
Did you know your grandfather?
I never knew him. He died a year before I was born.
And your brother actually was named Walter, even though Walter Anthony.
Anthony,
so
after my
known as Tony.
Mother's father, yeah.
So your father didn't take it easy on you because you were his child?
No. He liked us to be, to meet certain standards. And Dad was critical. I'm critical. I'm afraid I take after him in that respect, sometimes too critical.
You said that many members of the film crew were people you'd known since you were a baby. So were they nicer to you? Did they treat you as a professional or as John Huston's daughter?
Well, sort of both. I mean, they had affection for me because they'd known me for years. His script supervisor, Angie Allen, his sound man, Basil Fenton Smith, various photographers and producers that he worked with. But I think in a way it's very important for someone starting off as I was in some way to be anonymous because one's held back by the people who recognize you, who know what to expect from you. So in a way, I wasn't able to make any kind of a departure. Everyone knew who I was and what I was up to, and I was Dad's little girl. And that was sort of an impossible condition to escape.
It makes you feel like you're being judged every moment.
Yes, and also that you're a child, which, Lord knows, I was struggling against that.
But the good part of making that movie was that you earned enough to buy your mother a platinum watch she had admired at Cartier. She was wearing that watch when she died.
That's right.
After her funeral, you moved to New York City to start a modeling career. And one of the photographers you worked with frequently was Richard Avedon, who'd been a friend of your family. Hadn't he told them when you were younger that you wouldn't be a good model because your shoulders were too wide?
Yes, he told my mother that. But I think by the time I came to New York and decided to try out as a model, I think he'd sort of forgotten that initial statement and was the first one to work with me and then book me on a really beautiful big trip to Ireland under the auspices of Diana Vreeland, who was the great editor-in-chief of Vogue at the time.
So did you think you'd be a model?
I wanted to be a model because, first of all, you didn't get criticized by people like John Simon. And
was he particularly rough on you?
Oh, he was horrible. He said I looked like an exhausted gnu. That's GNU. yes, I think that was kind of unfair for somebody who is just finding their legs.
You should feel a little better about that because you're not the only one he's picked on over the years.
No, I know that.
Angelica Houston's memoir is a story lately told, coming of age in Ireland, London, and New York, published by Scribner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you wound up appearing in British Vogue, Italian Vogue, Harper's Bazaar. And when you were on assignment for Harper's, that's when you met this very highly regarded fashion photographer named Bob Richardson.
Yes.
How much older was he than you?
25 years older than me.
And you still fell in love?
Married? No, I didn't get married. I think he sort of possessed me. I was still very young. I was still smarting from the news of my mother's death. I was new in New York, a bit footless, and I think I saw him as a sort of refuge, and he seemed very protective, very interested in me, very attracted to me. And
so you moved in with him. Mm-hmm. But you had stayed at the Chelsea Hotel. You tell a very funny story about staying at the Chelsea.
Well, the Chelsea was a sort of horrible rite of passage, but I'm glad about those years. I'm glad I experienced it. But the Chelsea, I walked into my room one evening and there was a guy in the closet with a straight edge razor who threatened my life and cut the telephone cords. So I had to climb on the outside balconies to get into a neighboring room.
But that's when all the rock stars from England would stay there on their when they were doing the tour of the United States.
That's right. So it was a hot spot. And also all the Warhol people stayed there, Viva and a lot of Gerald Malanga, a lot of Warhol's crew.
How long did you and Bob Richardson stay together?
Almost 4 years.
And then he had a serious mental illness. Was that apparent from the start, or is this something that got worse as you were?
I guess if I'd known what was wrong to begin with, I would have known that he was sick from the start. But I had no experience with mental illness, and I didn't know that he was schizophrenic or bipolar.
It's been reported that you would accept a part in Downton Abbey if it was offered to you.
Well, it would depend on what the part was. Uh-huh. I was asked in an interview, you know, what my secret thrills were, and I mentioned Downton Abbey, and all of a sudden it sort of gone viral. I don't know that I'd accept any part, but it's certainly a show that I enjoy watching.
Well, do you like working in a TV series? Are you still recovering from your two seasons in Smash?
I am still recovering from it, actually. I very much enjoyed my first year, and the second year I started to have a few questions, but I think if the writing is great and the cast is as strong as it was on Smash, it's very interesting. I don't know if I'm really constructed for series television, but I think we have to try.
Now, I was reminded that your father also was a wonderful actor and did an amazing performance in Roman Polanski's Chinatown. But you had a different kind of experience with Roman Polanski, and I'm assuming that's also going to be mentioned in the new book?
That will be book two.
Yeah, the Samantha Geimer rape case situation?
Yeah, I mean, that whole episode I'll discuss in book two.
Can't wait to read it. Meanwhile, I love a photograph I've seen of you seated next to your father painting. It suggests you must have a lot of wonderful memories of him.
I do indeed. I have great memories of him. I still feel he's with me a lot of the time.
Do you want to direct?
I have directed, and I'd like to direct again. It would depend what. And I would have to say I'd prefer to direct for film than for television.
But now that you're a published author, I assume that we're going to start seeing novels and short stories as well. Meanwhile, we have this memoir, A Story Lately Told, Coming of Age in Ireland, London, and New York. It's published by Scribner. Angelica Houston, thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, my pleasure.